Welcome to the debate. Imagine you are navigating by this beautifully detailed map of a coastline. You can see the elevation lines, the city grids, I mean everything, right up to the shore.
Right.
But instead of stopping at the water's edge, the cartographer just kept drawing the highway lines straight out into the deep open ocean.
And, if you are navigating by that map, eventually you are going to drive right off a cliff and drown.
Exactly. Because the map forgot that it was a map, right? And the driver forgot that the paper they are holding is not the actual physical world.
Yeah, you reach a boundary.
And that specific failure, when a model pretends it can continue past its lawful edge, well, that's the tension at the center of our discussion today.
It is.
We are looking at the concept of nested causal modeling from Sid J.A. Hubbard's book, Zero Infinity: How Nothing Makes Sense in Science. The core premise here is that science's hardest problems, from, the deepest mysteries of quantum mechanics to the most pressing issues of climate policy, they are fundamentally boundary problems, not object problems.
Which leads us to the central question we really have to answer today. Does redefining nothing as a balanced reference state and enforcing strict boundary conditions on our mathematical models, does that provide a necessary paradigm shift for solving our greatest scientific paradoxes?
Or is this merely a philosophical relabeling of the limits of our current tools? Right. And well, my view is that this framework is a vital operational shift. I think it accurately diagnoses that paradoxes, like singularities and the vacuum energy catastrophe, happen because our models ignore their nested enclosures and just completely lack a necessary halt condition.
And I take the stance that while critiquing unbounded models is a useful philosophical reminder, substituting concrete physical constants with abstract concepts like zero infinity is just a semantic exercise. It basically frames our ignorance without actually advancing the mathematical mechanics of science.
Okay, to understand why this shift is so vital, I think we have to look at how we are currently trained to view the world.
Sure.
We are taught, literally from childhood, to start with things. A rock, a tree, a carbon molecule. We identify an object, we decompose it into its parts, and then explain how those parts interact. But Hubbard's argument here is that this order is entirely backwards. We should start with enclosures.
Can you clarify what you mean by an enclosure in this context? Because are we talking about a physical container, like a literal box?
No, not a literal box. Think of a whirlpool in a river. We give it a name. We can measure its rotation speed. You can point right to it.
Right, it has properties.
Yeah, we treat it like a thing, but you cannot take a whirlpool out of the river and put it on a desk.
Well, obviously.
Right. Its reality is entirely relational. It is a stable departure nested inside a larger enclosure, the river itself. So the framework applies this exact logic to our concept of nothing. Instead of seeing nothing as a blank void, like an empty room missing its furniture, we should understand it as a balanced reference architecture, a state of perfect cancellation.
Right. The concept referred to in the book as zero infinity or a vector equilibrium.
Exactly. Imagine a perfectly balanced tug of war.
Okay.
The rope isn't moving. If you only look at the motion, you might say nothing is happening, but there is massive, perfectly paired tension in that system. Everything in our universe is just a measurable departure from that balanced reference state.
Okay, but
So science fails, right? It produces these absurd infinities and paradoxes. When a model acts like a passport with no expiration date, it forgets the enclosure and just stretches way beyond its lawful boundary.
Look, it is a beautiful metaphor. I'll give you that. And there is a deep structural poetry to the idea that everything survives by exchanging with adjacent systems.
It makes intuitive sense.
It does, but elegance is not evidence. Defining a boundary where computation must stop, a so-called final frontier, is simply an admission of missing data. Proposing this perfectly balanced nothing forces us to ask what encloses the system, sure.
Which is a crucial
It
question.
is,
But pointing out that the map has ended does not actually help us draw the rest of the territory.
That's an interesting point, though I would frame it differently. Recognizing where the map ends is exactly what prevents you from doing bad math.
Ah, how so?
Well, if you don't know you've hit a boundary, you'll calculate the highway all the way to the bottom of the ocean and call it a breakthrough. Let's test this by looking at where our current maps produce the most glaring absurdities. I want to move from the abstract definition of nothing to, well, its most famous mathematical failure in physics, the vacuum energy catastrophe.
Ah, yes, the worst prediction in the history of physics.
Truly, by a factor of 120 orders of magnitude.
It's quite the rounding error.
Yeah, just a slight miscalculation. So let's break it down mechanically for a second. Modern physics looks at empty space and realizes it isn't actually empty. It is boiling with quantum fluctuations, you know, virtual particles popping in and out of existence.
Yes, quantum field theory treats the vacuum as a collection of fields, and each field has a ground state energy, a sort of baseline hum of activity.
Exactly. But here is the problem. How do we calculate the total energy of that vacuum? Currently, physicists calculate it by summing up the energies of all those microscopic fluctuations, basically adding them up as independent residents of a single container, all the way down to the smallest possible scale.
Right.
And when you add up the infinite possibilities of the vacuum, the resulting number is astronomically, catastrophically larger than the actual observable energy in the universe. I mean, if that math were true, the universe would have blown itself apart instantly.
Which it hasn't, thankfully.
Thankfully. The math is obviously broken. And the framework we are discussing suggests our order of accounting is fundamentally wrong.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. Physicists already know the vacuum is alive with fields, and they already attempt symmetry and cancellation. This is exactly what renormalization in quantum field theory is actually trying to do. They aren't just blindly adding numbers up without context.
But they are still counting the wrong thing. They are trying to count the totality of possibility rather than the lawful residual of the enclosure. Hubbard says we must pair departures across this balanced reference state first. You know, balance first, departure second, and only then measure what is left over.
Let me use an analogy here. If I want to know how full a theater is, I can get a very different number depending on how I measure it, right?
Sure.
I can count every physical seat in the building. I can count every ticket sold. I can count every person who actually shows up, or I can count every person who stays until the final curtain. It's all the same theater, but different counting methods yield entirely different realities.
Okay.
So telling physicists they are experiencing a catastrophe just because they are counting the seats instead of the tickets is quite frankly dismissive of the actual mechanics. Hubbard is just telling them to count a different tier of reality without providing the formal calculus to do so.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. It isn't just counting differently, it is recognizing what physically interacts with the boundary.
What do you mean?
Think about a massive global bank clearing billions of transactions a day.
Okay, I'm with you.
If you want to know the bank's actual real-world exposure at the end of the day, you don't sum up every single deposit, withdrawal, and internal transfers as if they are freestanding piles of money.
Well, no, you look at the net.
Exactly. That total transactional motion is massive. But if the debits and credits are perfectly paired internally, the real physical exposure is only the net residual difference, the tiny fraction of money that actually crosses the boundary of the bank to another institution.
So you are saying standard physics is trying to calculate the gross transaction volume rather than the net residual?
Precisely. If you hand a physicist new calculus, but they are still trapped in the old enclosure, still treating infinite quantum possibilities as freestanding residents of a volume, the math will just find a new way to break. The conceptual shift has to come first. You treat infinite possibility as a paired departure held inside a lawful enclosure. You only measure the boundary residual.
That is a compelling argument, but have you considered that in physics we have actual empirical measurements? Take the Casimir effect.
Oh, sure.
If you place two uncharged metallic plates incredibly close together in a vacuum, they are pushed together by the quantum fluctuations outside them being greater than the ones between them. The vacuum energy has a mechanical, measurable force.
It does.
So Changing our philosophical stance on what constitutes nothing does not inherently give us a new equation to bridge the gap between that quantum mechanical reality and general relativity. Saying measure the boundary residual sounds profound, but without replacing the formal calculus, it's really just a critique from the peanut gallery.
But wait, the Casimir effect actually proves the point. The Casimir effect doesn't measure the absolute total energy of the vacuum. It explicitly measures a difference in energy between boundaries.
Well, yes.
The plates act as an enclosure. It behaves exactly the way a nested causal model predicts. But to your point about bridging quantum mechanics and general relativity, we absolutely can see this bridge if we apply the exact same boundary logic to the macro scale. Let's expand outward to the ultimate cosmic boundaries, singularities in the Big Bang.
Let's do it. Because this is exactly where I think the concept of the broken map becomes a liability.
How so? When we look at a black hole, the equations of general relativity famously break down. If our listeners are unfamiliar with the mechanics here, general relativity relates gravity to mass and distance. As you compress a dying star into a smaller and smaller space, the distance between the mass approaches zero.
And dividing by zero is bad news.
Right. Because you are essentially dividing by zero space, the math spits out an infinity. Infinite density. Infinite curvature. Traditionally, physics has looked at that result and said, wow, nature produces infinitely dense points. But the nested causal framework argues that general relativity is simply being pushed past its lawful boundary.
Right. The claim is that a singularity is not a physical destination in nature. It is a transition where the map lacks the enclosure to continue.
Exactly. It's the Heilig drawn into the ocean. The math produces an infinity, not because the physical world is infinite, but because the model lacks a halt condition. It literally forgot it was a model. So let me pose this to you.
Go ahead.
If the cosmic microwave background, you know, the residual heat of the early universe, is simply evidence arriving now, from a hot, dense, early state, isn't it scientifically dangerous to let the Big Bang singularity become a mandatory outer enclosure? Doesn't treating a mathematical breakdown as a literal genesis event stifle other predictive architectures?
I come at it from a different way. I completely agree that the sky is older than our certainty. Cosmology absolutely suffers from origin story syndrome.
Yes.
We take the thinnest slice of data at the very edge of our observable horizon, and we build our most dogmatic frameworks around it. So, on the danger of turning a breakdown into a genesis event, we are totally aligned. But here is the problem with your halt condition.
What's the problem?
Arguing that a singularity is merely a halt condition, you know, a final frontier where computation must stop, it gives scientists permission to stop inquiring. If we reach the center of a black hole or the first fractions of the observable universe, and we just say, the model has reached its boundary, time to stop, we risk abandoning the search for a unifying theory of quantum gravity.
I don't think it means we abandon it.
But the friction, the paradox, the mathematical breakdown, that infinity is the exact pressure that forces us to discover the next map. If you institutionalize the idea of a final frontier, you institutionalize scientific complacency.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning, because a halt condition doesn't destroy inquiry, it disciplines it. It says, stop here, not forever, but until you can state the next enclosure.
Mm.
That is the opposite of giving up. It is an act of extreme intellectual honesty.
But identifying that larger system requires tools. It requires us to push the current tools until they actually snap under the pressure. You don't know you need a new enclosure until the old one produces an infinity.
Look, you're completely right that we need the mathematical breakdown to alert us that we need the next map. I concede that point. The breakdown is absolutely essential. But where the breakdown happens isn't the physical reality itself. That's the distinction.
I see what you're saying, but...
Once the tool snaps, you shouldn't spend 50 years mathematically trying to justify the snapped piece of metal as a new fundamental law of nature. If you don't enforce a halt condition, you get physicists spending decades trying to mathematically justify an impossible physical reality, like infinite density, rather than stepping back and asking, what is the larger system projecting conditions inward here?
I see the value in stepping back, certainly. It prevents the tunnel vision that, let's be real, plagues hyper-specialized physics. But I still worry that endlessly searching for the larger system becomes this paralyzing infinite regress.
Which brings us perfectly to how this plays out outside of theoretical physics.
Let's ground this a bit.
Yeah.
because the consequences of confusing the map for the territory touch tangible, everyday human realities. Let's look at practical reductionism and the climate continuum. Because how we treat the boundary of a black hole is exactly how we treat the boundary of an earthly ecosystem.
You're talking about Hubbard's claim that climate is not carbon.
Yes. And, you know, to be crystal clear, industrial emissions matter. Carbon dioxide traps heat. That is basic atmospheric physics. But carbon is just one variable nested inside a continuum. It is enclosed by soil health, water cycles, human industry, and baseline survival needs. When carbon becomes the whole map, policy becomes incredibly destructive.
Destructive in what way?
Because the policy optimizes internally, while the living world outside the model just degrades. Let's look at the farm analogy. A farmer knows perfectly well that a farm is not a single emissions number. A farm is a deeply nested enclosure.
Right.
It's the microbial structure of the soil, the root networks, the local weather memory. It is human labor, machinery, and family debt.
It is a complex system.
Exactly. But if a policymaker hundreds of miles away enforces optimization for a single signal, let's say aggressively reducing carbon, without understanding that enclosure, well, they might force the farmer to adopt practices that destroy the soil's microbial life or bankrupt the family entirely.
Yeah, the collateral damage.
Right. You might protect a forest on a spreadsheet to meet a global carbon target, but mathematically justify displacing the indigenous people who maintain that forest for centuries. The policy fails because it measures one variable and violently damages the nested system that gave the variable meaning in the first place.
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered the inherent danger in the law of nested infinities?
What danger?
This framework insists that nesting continues in both directions, larger within larger, smaller within smaller. If every problem requires looking at the larger enclosure, the problem becomes paralyzed by sheer complexity.
How does it paralyze it, though?
Let's step away from climate for a second and look at a behavioral example. Say a child is acting out in school. The framework says you can't just look at the child. You must look at the enclosure, the family.
Right.
But wait, the family is nested in a larger enclosure, the local school system, the neighborhood, and that is nested in the digital attention economy, screen time algorithms, local labor markets, housing costs, inherited generational stress. I could go on.
Well, that is an accurate description of reality, yes.
Yes, but it is operationally useless. Suddenly, to help a child with a behavioral issue in a second grade classroom, you have to solve global capitalism and the digital attention economy. You can't do it. Single variable reductionism, like setting strict carbon emission targets or giving a kid a specific behavioral intervention, is a necessary operational tool to force action. It is not a willful ignorance of the boundary, it is a strategic choice. We have to move the needle on a climate crisis that will literally drown coastal cities, while we could otherwise spend the next 50 years debating the exact boundaries of the nested life support continuum.
Okay, that is a fair critique of over-contextualizing, but that is exactly why the framework emphasizes finding the active enclosure. The art of nested causality is not to include every atom in the universe in your model. The art is to find the specific boundary that, if changed, actually changes the pattern.
But how do you legislate an active enclosure? I don't disagree that top-down policy causes severe collateral damage, but let's look at the alternative. If we throw out the carbon targets because they don't capture the entire living essence of the soil biome and the farmer's debt-to-income ratio, what do we replace them with?
Well,
how do you regulate a continuum? We end up in a perpetual committee meeting where everyone is discussing the holistic boundaries of the problem, and absolutely no one is pulling the carbon out of the air.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. It's not about throwing out the carbon targets.
Okay.
The framework literally demands that we measure harm more completely. It's asking us to stop worshiping the signal and start respecting the system. It is a discipline of attention. You still reduce carbon, but you place a firm halt condition on the policy. We will reduce carbon up to the point that it begins to degrade the soil biome or bankrupt the local community. The boundary acts as a check against institutional tunnel vision.
So it operates more as a fail-safe than a replacement for the primary metric.
Yes, it replaces the infinite regress of reductionism with honest boundaries. If we don't do this, our models will eventually eat the very reality they were built to serve. You get policies that look perfect on a spreadsheet but leave scorched earth in reality.
You know, the map ends before the world does. I will concede
That is a profound check on scientific and institutional ego. We have absolutely seen fields, from theoretical physics to global economics, double down on failing models simply because entirely too many careers were invested in the old map.
Exactly.
Friction is a terrible thing to waste, and too often we pave over it with a new theoretical patch rather than admitting the enclosure has shattered.
So you agree the boundary is primary?
I agree the boundary is a necessary philosophical check. But where we will have to leave our disagreement is on the mathematical utility of zero infinity. I still view it as a philosophical lens rather than a mathematically actionable reference state.
Fair enough.
It forces us to ask brilliant questions about our blind spots. It tells us, unequivocally, that we are standing at the edge of the coastline. I just don't believe it builds the boat we need to cross the water.
And I would argue that recognizing you are standing at the edge of the coastline is the very thing that prompts you to start building the boat rather than continuing to pour asphalt directly into the tide.
It certainly forces you to justify why you draw the lines where you do. And perhaps that is the ultimate value of any great intellectual friction. It operates as a mirror, you know, reflecting our own assumptions back at us.
I think we can both agree on the immense value of that discipline of attention. Looking for the zero that is not empty. Looking for the exchange that is mistaken for a loss. Whether our listeners are managing a company, studying the quantum vacuum, or trying to enact local policy, recognizing the active enclosures around us might fundamentally change how we interact with the world.
It certainly changes how you look at the math.
Which brings us back to our cartographer. The next time you find yourself looking at a predictive model, a piece of global policy, or even a deeply held personal belief, look very closely at the edges. Because if the highway lines are extending straight into the open ocean, it isn't the water that's broken, it's the map.